Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Hey, Dan here. Before we start the show, I want to tell you about a live recording of this podcast that we're doing in New York City on March 28th. I will be interviewing two frequent flyers from this show, the legendary meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein, who will be just coming off a three-month solo silent meditation retreat, and Dr. Mark Epstein, a Buddhist therapist and best-selling author. The event will actually be a celebration of the 10th anniversary of my first book, 10% Happier, and a percentage of the proceeds will go to the New York Insight Meditation Center. Come early if you want for a VIP guided meditation and Q&A with me. Thanks to our friends over at Audible for sponsoring this show and the event. Tickets on sale right now at symphonyspace.org. It's the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hello, everybody. How we doing? Whether you like it or not, if you want to get stuff done in this world, you need to be able to communicate effectively with other human beings. If you want to sell somebody something, if you want them to do something for you, if you want to convince them to see things your way, you usually need to be able to talk about it. This is true at work, with your family, and pretty much anytime you come in contact with another Homo sapien. The stakes are high here. As I have said a million times, we are social creatures. We evolved for interpersonal contact. And if you can't do that effectively, you are likely to struggle and suffer in your life. The good news is that increasingly scientists are studying how to communicate better, what works and what doesn't. Even better news, one of the finest journalists of our age, Charles Duhigg, is now out with a whole book where he dives into said research and describes in very lucid terms how to deploy it in your life, how to become what he calls a super communicator. Charles is a writer at The New Yorker magazine. Before that, he was at The New York Times. He wrote a massive bestseller called The Power of Habit, which is all about the science of habit formation. And he followed that up with a book about the science of productivity called Smarter, Faster, Better. And his latest book is called Super Communicators. In this conversation, we talked about how he defines a super communicator, the four rules for a meaningful conversation, how and when to deploy vulnerability, how to transform shallow questions into deep ones, the fast friends procedure, and how to form the habits that are necessary in order to become a super communicator. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger: never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. Charles Duhigg, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
I consider it a major oversight, a form of malpractice that we have not had you on thus far, because you've written books. Your new book is about communication. We're going to talk about that a lot, but you've written about productivity and habit formation, and those are things that this show cares about a lot. So,
Well, I was a big fan of your book. I'm a tremendous fan, actually, and I use the app regularly, so it's a real treat to come and spend some time with you.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. So how did you get to this subject of communication? It's not necessarily a clean shot from habits and productivity in the tech world to communication, although maybe I'm just not seeing it.
Well, I think there was a couple of things that happened. The first is that, you know, I had written about habit formation and about sort of where real productivity comes from. And both of those are very internal, right? It's about looking at yourself. But the more time I spent in the world, the more I realized, you know, a lot of the work that we have to do is on ourselves, but 80% of the time that we spend is with other people. And the ways that we relate to other people have enormous impacts on our happiness and on our health and in how we move through the world. I also had this situation I don't think is uncommon, which is I often found that I was coming home from work and I'd had a bad day. And I would turn to my wife and I would start complaining about my day. I'd start, you know, my boss is a jerk and my coworkers don't appreciate me. And my wife very rationally and practically would say, oh, you know, let's solve this problem. Like, why don't you invite your boss out to lunch and you guys can get to know each other a little bit better. And what I should have done and said, that's great advice. But what I did every time instead is I would have this instinct to be like, to get even angrier, to say like, you're not listening to me and I want you to be outraged on my behalf. And then she would get frustrated. And I had similar experiences at work where I became a manager and did a bad job of communicating with others. And I began to wonder, there must be this science to communication and I wanted to understand it. So that was kind of where it came from.
The science to communication. So there is a body of research here?
There absolutely is. And in fact, in the last 10 years, we are living through a golden age of understanding communication and conversation and connection in a way that we never have before. And one of the big insights that really shaped how I thought about this is when I was talking to neurologists and I was telling them about this problem with my wife, and they would say, well, the mistake you're making here is that most of us think of a discussion as being about one thing, right? We're talking about where to go to dinner or on vacation. And what they said was, that's actually wrong, that each discussion is actually made up of multiple different kinds of conversations. And most of them fall into one of three buckets. There's practical conversations, which are about sort of decision-making, about trying to figure out what we actually want to discuss. There are emotional conversations, where the goal is not to solve the problem, but simply to tell you how I'm feeling about the problem, see you acknowledge those feelings, and then share with me your feelings. And then there's social conversations where we're talking about how we relate to other people and how we relate to society. And they said one of the things that happens a lot is that two people will be in the same discussion and be having different kinds of conversations. So when I came home from work and I was upset, I was having an emotional conversation. And my wife responded, again, very reasonably, with a practical conversation. She responded by, let's figure out how to solve this problem. And because we weren't having the same kind of conversation at the same time, we failed to connect with each other. And that's where the miscommunication comes from. And when I heard that, it's sort of the simple formula for thinking about how to connect with another person, suddenly I was like, oh, I understand why this science is important.
Mm-hmm. I've had the same fight with my wife. and I've also been the person doing what our wives have done. You know, I've been on both sides of this. And I'm sure many people listening can empathize. Just to put a, you know, hang a lantern on the three kinds of conversations, because I think that's really important. It's a big theme in your book, and I don't want it to just slip by people. The three kinds are, first, what is this really about? The second, how do we feel? And the third is, who are we? Can you just walk us through these three again? Because this seems really central.
It is. It's foundational to what we've learned in the last decade. The practical conversation, the what's this really about, is a discussion where the two of us are trying to figure out what we actually want out of this conversation. And then if that's fairly simple, like making a plan or a decision, to go ahead and make a plan and a decision together to figure out what kind of logic we're going to use to make choices together. Most conversations start with what's this really about? Because oftentimes when you sit down to talk with someone, you don't have a formal agenda. You haven't sort of said like, I'd like to talk about finances and then I'd like to talk about, you know, our feelings about last night's TV show. So there's a little negotiation, actually referred to in psychology literature as a quiet negotiation, about what are we going to talk about? And also, what are the rules that we'll implicitly agree upon? Can we interrupt each other? Is this something where we can be casual, or do we need to be formal? Can we make jokes? So that's the first conversation. The second conversation is the emotional conversation. How do we feel? And this is a very different conversation, because the goal here is not to come to an agreement together. It's to express how we ourselves as an individual are feeling to the other person. And what's important is that we need to see them acknowledge that feeling. Mm-hmm. And then, even better if they want to share their feelings back with us. And then there's the third type of conversation, which is the social conversation. Who are we? And this is a conversation that's a little bit harder to recognize, but it happens all the time, where I come into a conversation and I feel like my background gives me a different perspective than your background. And I want to explain how my background made me who I am. Or I want to talk about other people and how we relate to other people. Or I want to gossip about the office and what's going on there. Those are conversations about how we relate to society and how society relates to us and how we relate to other people and they relate to us. And that's a conversation about who are we that's different from the other two kinds of conversations. All these conversations are important and good, but what's important is to be having the same kind of conversation at the same time.
How do you do that? Because that seems tricky.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Like, how do we actually make this happen? And the answer is something that's known as the matching principle, which basically says that you have two jobs in every conversation. The first is to actually pay attention to what the other person wants to talk about. And then the second job is to either match them or invite them to match you. So for instance, let's say we get into a conversation, it's a work meeting, let's say. And right off the bat, someone says, okay, look, the goal here is to figure out next year's budget. Okay, it seems like this is a practical conversation, right? But the next person who speaks says, yeah, I want to talk about next year's budget because I'm really worried about layoffs and I don't want to have any layoffs. And then someone else says, yeah, my people are really, really anxious about the layoffs. Like, we got to figure out if we're going to have layoffs. That's a signal that people aren't actually here initially for a practical conversation. They're here for an emotional conversation because they're using emotional words like worried and anxious. Training ourselves to pick up on these small little clues about what kind of conversation is occurring allows us to match that person and say back to them, I hear that you're worried and I hear that you're anxious, and let's talk about how to mitigate those anxieties and how to deal with our employees when they're really panicked. And then we can get on to figuring out the actual budget and whether we have to have these layoffs. As a super communicator, what I've done there is I've said, I want to match you. And then I'm going to invite you to match me, because at some point we got to talk about the budget.
You mentioned super communicator. I want to get to that term in a second. But since we're on the matching principle, is it just about picking up on the words people use, or can it be something about body language?
Absolutely. Body language is critical. Right? Paying attention to the expressions on their face, to the tone of their voice, to what you hear. That's incredibly important. And in fact, the other big discovery in the science is that when we connect with each other, when we're having a genuine conversation, something incredible happens in our bodies. If we could measure it, like during this conversation, what we would see is that your pupils and my pupils start dilating at the same rate. The electrical impulses along our skin will start to match each other. And most importantly, our brains will start to look like each other. That's what communication is. It's known as neural entrainment. The goal of communication is to take an idea in my head or a feeling in my head and help you understand it, help you feel it. And when that works, our brains begin to start looking alike. And in that moment, as we become neurally entrained, we really connect and understand each other.
It is. I think about this a lot, and I apologize if anybody listening has heard me say this, but words escape my mouth hole and jump over an unfathomable chasm to your ears. And then they're cut with your childhood, your biases, your political beliefs, your mood. And it's a miracle that we ever are clearly understood.
It's amazing, isn't it? That, like, and we do it like for hours and hours a day without even thinking about it.
Yes.
What's interesting is that you and I are both making literally hundreds of small choices as we're communicating with each other. And we're almost completely unaware of those choices. Mm. because we've evolved to have this capacity. Humans' superpower is communication. That's what sets us apart from every other species in a way that's allowed us to thrive. And it's amazing.
Yes, and it's amazing that given that this is our superpower, this is a defining feature of our species, we need it to get through the world. It's amazing that we suck at it so badly and nobody teaches us how to fucking do it.
It's as if like Superman came to Earth and he was like, well, 30% of the time when I jump in the air, I can fly. But 70% of the time, I just fall on my face.
Exactly.
You need that instruction book, right? And that's what science has tried to figure out in the last decade.
And I know in some schools, they teach what's called social and emotional learning, which is based in part on some of Daniel Goleman's work about emotional intelligence. And Danny's good friend has been on the show a bunch of times. We'll put some links to his conversations in the show notes. And Danny's work is, of course, based on research done in the halls of academia. So I know that some schools get social and emotional learning, but I certainly, coming up, never got taught how to have a successful conversation. And I'm not sure most kids these days are getting that conversation. We've created a world, in fact, for kids that drives them further into their own information silos and away from connection.
Well, you're exactly right that this isn't being taught yet the way that it should be. And that's one of the reasons I wrote Super Communicators, is because I was hoping that we could reignite an interest in learning how to communicate and have conversations across divides. Another thing that America's gotten worse at over the last couple of years. But there's a simple way, I think, to bring this to kids or to anyone who's listening, which is, and I'll ask you this question, Dan. So if you have had a bad day, like you're in a terrible mood or you got some bad news, and you want to call someone who will make you feel better, do you know who that person is?
Yeah.
Okay, who is it?
Notwithstanding what I said earlier about having had the same fight you had with your wife, with my wife, that person is my wife.
Yeah. Yeah. And now let me ask you a couple questions. And I'm sure your wife is wonderful. It's a wonderful woman. However,
she's okay.
is she the funniest person you know? Like if you had to do a comedy show, would you definitely ask her?
No.
But does she laugh a lot when she's talking to you? Yeah.
Yes.
And my guess is that many of the times that she's laughing, it's not in response to something funny. It's in response to wanting to create an emotional connection or in trying to show you that she wants to connect with you. So here's another question. I'm sure that she is good at talking to people, but is she the best interviewer you know? Like if you were to put her up against your journalism colleagues?
When I see her in conversation as a human, not technically interviewing somebody, she can bring information out of people and make them comfortable.
So it sounds like she's a super communicator, not just with you, but with other people.
Yeah.
And if we were to study how she's communicating with you and others in those situations, what we would see is that she's asking up to 10 times as many questions as everyone else in the conversation. And oftentimes we don't even register it because a lot of the questions are things like, oh, that's interesting. Tell me more. Or what did you think about that? Or why did that happen? There are these little questions that invite you to tell her more about who you are. And there's a handful of principles that the super communicators can do. And the important thing to recognize is that all of us are super communicators at one time or another. Your wife is a super communicator with you, and you are with her. The difference is that there are some people who have thought about this a little bit more deeply, who have practiced it a little bit more, and they can be super communicators whenever they want to be. Because oftentimes when it happens in our life, it just sort of, it feels like chance, right? Like either we know someone so well or we walk into a meeting and we know exactly what to say, but then we walk into another meeting and we can't persuade anyone. Super communicators are people who consistently can do this because they've thought about how conversations work. They've learned to pick up on those cues. They've learned to ask more questions and laugh more. And any of us can learn to do that.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. It can be an incredibly skillful way to move through the world, to ask sincere questions. And yet I have found that sometimes people will say, are you interviewing me? And so what am I doing wrong in those cases? Because I feel like I'm taking this principle and misusing it sometimes.
I think those of us who are journalists fall into this a lot, right? And it's actually because it makes us feel comfortable in a situation that might be hard. So there's two things I would say. The first is What's important is the kinds of questions you're asking. And within psychology, there's this thing known as deep questions. And a deep question is something that asks the other person to describe their values, their beliefs, or their experiences. And these deep questions can be super casual and easy to ask. They don't appear deep. So for instance, you spend a lot of your time podcasting. Do you love doing this podcast, or does it feel like a chore?
75% of the time, I love it.
Yeah, why is that?
Because I get to talk to people like you who are fascinating.
So that was a kind of casual question. That was an easy question to ask, but it was a deep question because you just told me something really insightful about you, which is that, first of all, you do this thing that you love, but you only love it 75% of the time, right? You recognize that there's parts of it that you don't love. And number two, I just learned something about your values, which is you value interesting conversations. You value being able to connect with other people. You revealed something about yourself. Now, the way that I make it feel like not an interview is to share similarly something about myself and to say, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because I'm a writer for The New Yorker and I write books and I, like you, I love most of the activity, but then there's some parts of it that I just find terrifying and hard and that make me feel bad about myself when a chapter isn't going well. And by sharing that with you, I've given you a chance to see who I really am, right? Mm-hmm. That I'm someone who can be honest enough to say, like, I get scared when I'm writing. And obviously the fact that I'm mentioning that means that writing is so important to me. So those deep questions that can be really easy to ask and can be as simple as saying, what do you make of that? Like, oh, I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Did you like growing up there? Deep questions are a way to draw out who the other person is and what kind of conversation they're looking for. And then when we respond in a similar vein, what we're doing is we're creating that connection. And that's what makes it feel like not an interview, but a conversation.
At least one thing you're pointing to in all of the foregoing is that these strategies or techniques, whatever you want to call them, can be very skillful, asking questions, dropping in little anecdotes about yourself. But they can also be unskillful because if you ask too many of the wrong kind of questions or if you talk too much about yourself at the wrong time, you don't read the room. And all of it can at some point start to feel a little techniquey, like you're programmed because you read this book and you're trying to do this stuff and it comes off as a little cultish and awkward. And so these are great skills, but they have to be skillfully deployed.
Oh, another way I put it is they have to be practiced a little bit and then you will automatically stop thinking about them. So there's the book has a bunch of stories in it of different situations where people have used these tools and learned different things. And one of them is about this trial. And we go into the jury room to listen. They actually recorded the jury deliberations, which has only happened about 5 or 6 times in American history. And what's interesting is that there's this one guy who is a super communicator who everyone else doesn't actually like. They're talking about whether this gentleman should go to jail for carrying around a gun. And everyone in the room is either stay-at-home moms or they work in factories. And this guy is a university professor who studies Derrida. So, like, he's a total outlier in this group. And everyone else, I talked to some of the jurors. They were like, yeah, I didn't trust this guy at first. Like, he seemed just too weird to me. And what's interesting is he doesn't talk that much. But when he talks, you can now recognize that it's deliberate, that he has thought about what he wants to say and how he wants to influence or impact other people. And as a result, as you're watching this jury deliberation unfold, almost invisibly to everyone in the room, this guy dips in and he helps bring everyone to a consensus by listening closely and understanding what kind of conversations other people are asking for, by matching them and inviting them to match him. He only speaks about 6% of the entire deliberation, but his comments are so impactful that it changes everyone else's mind. And I talked to him and he said, you know, I didn't really think about it that way. It just felt natural to do this. But it's because he had spent time thinking about conversation, because he had practiced it in conversations with his wife or his friends, that it became natural and intuitive. And in many ways, that's the goal of the book and of life, is to let these instincts that we have, these intuitions, to let them come to the fore. Because very often, particularly in contemporary society, there are things that conspire against those instincts that make us mistrustful of our intuitions. But the more we learn to listen to those, the more the natural capacity for communication comes out.
You've used this term super communicator many times, and I have yet to, speaking of malpractice, give you an opportunity to define it. So let's do it now.
As I mentioned, all of us are super communicators, right? There are times that you have a conversation and you walk away feeling wonderful. You feel like you really connected to the other person, or you walk into work and you know exactly what to say to your boss in order to get them on board with your plan or give you a raise. Those moments when we really connect with other people, those are moments of super communication. And there are some people, as I mentioned, who can do this more consistently. So you mentioned that you would call your wife. When I have a really bad day, I call this guy named Greg. The thing about Greg is that he's not the most insightful friend. He's insightful, but not like, he's not like an oracle. And he's not the funniest friend, and he's not the most successful friend. But every time I talk to him, I just feel better about myself and the world. He is a super communicator, and he can do this with anyone. It's like this magic power that he has. He is a super communicator because he has thought enough about communication till it's become an instinct and second nature to draw someone out and help them see the best parts of themselves. It's not a technical definition, but a super communicator is someone who has thought enough about communication to know how to recognize what kind of conversation is happening and then match other people and invite them to match themselves so that we really feel connected to them.
And your contention is that anybody can train themselves.
Absolutely. There's another story in the book about a CIA officer who on his first posting is like just screwing up the job completely. He's about to get fired. And then he manages to recruit one overseas operative during this dinner. And the way he does it is by basically giving up, just being like, I have no idea what I'm doing here. I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm really, really sorry that I've been harassing you for weeks. And that inspires her to trust him. And she becomes one of the best assets in the Middle East. The reason why that's important is because that guy went on to actually become a trainer inside the CIA and train other agents and intelligence officers how to do this. And what he found was with just about 6 weeks of classes, anyone could become a super communicator. I talked to one woman who had trained under him and she was like, I'm an introvert. I don't like people. I basically became an analyst and they forced me into the field. I felt awkward all the time. And he just taught me like some simple lessons and I would just repeat them in my head. And it was like magic. It was like I could communicate with anyone. Hmm. We all know how to become super communicators once we're given the right instructions.
Coming up, Charles Duhigg talks about the four rules for a meaningful conversation and how and when to deploy vulnerability. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home. And I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable. And the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good-looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier. Before we get back to the show, a quick reminder, in honor of World Meditation Week, we're offering 40% off a subscription to the 10% Happier app. Head over to 10%.com/40. That's 10% spelled out .com/40 to get started. All right, so let's dive into some of the instructions.
Okay.
What are the four rules for a meaningful conversation?
So the four rules for a meaningful conversation are, first of all, figure out what kind of conversation is happening, right? Look for some clues that indicate to you where the other person's head is at, what they want to talk about. And the best way to do that is to ask those deep questions. Simply ask something that asks the other person to talk about their background, their beliefs, their experiences, their values. When they do that, they're going to give you a hint about whether they're in a practical state of mind, an emotional state of mind, or a social state of mind. Once you get that out of the way and you know what kind of conversation and you've matched each other, then at some point you need to nudge that into emotional territory if you're not already there. You need to ask the other person, this is step number two, how they feel, and then you need to acknowledge what they have told you and share something about how you feel. The reason why this is important is because there's this thing that happens inside our brains. It's been hardwired by evolution. When someone else shares with us something that appears vulnerable, we cannot help but listen to them. And when we share something vulnerable back, we will feel closer to each other, even if we're enemies, even if we have nothing in common. This emotional contagion makes us feel closer to each other. The third step of that conversation is to figure out what each person wants from this discussion. You know, we sit down and we're having a beer together over a hamburger, and in the back of my mind should be this little question. So Dan's meeting with me, is it just because he wants to be social and catch up? Or is there something he wants to get off his chest? Or does he have a problem that he's trying to solve? And so the way that we do that is we engage in this quiet negotiation. We try experiments. While you're talking, I might laugh and interrupt and see how you react. And I'm going to pay attention to how you react. And that might tell me whether laughing and interruptions is the way that we're going to communicate with each other, or if this should be more formal. That's not appropriate. I'm going to ask you a question. And then as you're answering it, I might remain quiet even after you've stopped speaking to show that I'm thinking about it. And again, I'm going to pay attention to how you're reacting to that to try and figure out what are the rules that you're looking for in this conversation. That's the third step, doing these little experiments. And just because an experiment fails doesn't mean that it's a failure. Like if every experiment succeeds, then you're not doing science right. These little experiments are to figure out, what do you want from this conversation? What do I want from this conversation? Because I might not know at first. And what are the rules that we're going to implicitly agree on for how we relate to each other? Then the fourth step is that at some point, we need to take this out of just ourselves, and we need to make it part of a bigger conversation about how we relate to other people. So perhaps you're talking about a problem you have, and then I ask, when this happens at work or when this happens with your wife, how is it different? And when you start talking about that, what you're telling me about is you're telling me about how you see yourself as a member of society and how you relate to other people. And what's really important is that I acknowledge that, particularly if there's differences. Oftentimes, if we're in a conversation, we feel like we should ignore the differences or paper over them. But if you are black and I am white, and we're talking about something like criminal justice, your experiences are very different from mine. The way you relate to society is very different. And if I don't acknowledge that, it feels like I'm not really seeing you. Even something as simple as saying, you grew up in a two-parent household and I grew up in a one-parent household. And so we might see this a little bit differently, but here's my take on parenting. And then the other person saying, like, thank you for sharing that with me. You're right. I think that if I'd grown up in a one-parent household, it would have been different. Or that's interesting. Thanks for letting me know that. That's the social conversation. That's the fourth step. And if you do those four things, you're going to walk away from that discussion. And it doesn't have to take a lot of time. It can take like, you know, 7 minutes. But if you do those four things, you are going to walk away from that conversation feeling like you've understood the other person. They've understood you. And like you actually feel close. And there's one element that we haven't discussed. It's equally important to show the other person that you're listening. Oftentimes when someone is talking, we might look at them and like stare into their eyes and show our interest on our face. But talking is such a cognitively complex activity. We usually don't notice what the other person is doing, right? We're just focused on like what next word should come out of my mouth. And so the way that we show this, that we want to connect, is that when someone stops talking, we prove to them that we were listening by saying something like, what I heard you say was, or, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because I've had something similar in my life. Conversations that have a lot of conflict where it's really tense. There's a whole chapter in the book about these conversations between gun owners and gun control advocates, because this group wanted to bring them together to have productive conversations. And what they found was that if they trained them in just one thing called looping for understanding, that in a conflict conversation, if I do three things, I first ask you a question, I repeat back in my own words what I heard you say, and then thirdly, I ask you if I got it right. If I do those three things, almost inevitably, you are going to believe that I am listening to you, that I want to understand. And then we can't help it. You are going to listen to me in return.
Looping for understanding. So that is a key technique if you're in conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And conflict can mean like having a tough conversation, right? Like, or talking about something where you don't see eye to eye. But particularly if you're in a fight with someone, if you're at the office and you have a foe at the office, if you do looping for understanding, the relationship's going to get better.
There are, you know, lots of different terminologies here for context. We've done many interviews on the show about the skill of communication, and I've been working for 4 or 5 years with these communication coaches who I've talked about a lot on the show, Dan Klerman and Mudita Nisker. They have something called reflective listening, which you just talked about as part two in looping for understanding, which is just to say back to somebody what you've heard in your own words. And I have found that to be perhaps the single most powerful communication tool I've ever encountered.
That's really interesting. When is that useful? Like, what kind of conversation are you having where repeating back, reflecting what you've heard really seems to make a difference?
It's useful in every context. We've just finished talking about meaningful conversations and then conversations where there's disagreement or potential conflict. And not all conversations fall into either of those buckets. But reflective listening, I have found, works in any kind of conversation because it speaks to a primordial need that we all have that we may not even be aware of, which is we want to be understood. You can reflect back to somebody in any context and some part of them is deeply satisfied and they may not know you're doing it.
No. And even if they do know you're doing it, they still like it, right? Like just because someone gives us a compliment and that we know that they're trying to win us over, that doesn't mean that we enjoy the compliment any less. We still like being praised. Can I ask you a question? You are a professional communicator. And it's actually interesting to me that you've been working with communication consultants and experts. What did you see in your own life that suggested to you, like, I need to know more about this. I need someone to help me get better at this.
Well, it was suggested to me that I needed to get better at this. Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I am a professional communicator I was trained as a broadcaster, so I'm reasonably good at sitting in front of a camera and talking to invisible millions, you know, and imparting information in a lucid manner to them. That's quite a bit different than one-on-one communication or small group communication. And in those settings, I was often boorish and bullheaded. And it was pointed out to me that I needed to, you know, I came up in broadcast news, which was very much a star-based system. Not that I was ever at the level of being a true star, but I was, you know, surrounded by people like Ted Koppel and Peter Jennings and Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer. Some of them were actually very good communicators, but there was an ethos of shut up and do what I tell you. I think incorporated a little bit too much of that into my personal style.
And why do you think you did that? Like, if you were to take me back to before somebody said to you, you got to work on this, what were they seeing that you weren't seeing? And what was motivating it on your behalf?
What was communicated to me was that there was an impatience and a dismissiveness and an insistence on having it my own way. And why was I doing that? I think in part because of the environment I grew up in, but I think a lot of it was very much part of my pre-existing personality. You know, I think all of us to some degree have an inner tyrant. Mine was reasonably prominent, and yeah. It doesn't take much looking up the family tree to see where I got that. I think I came by it honestly and in several ways.
So what I hear you saying, and tell me if I'm getting this wrong, is that you had these instincts. You had these instincts to kind of be a dogmatic communicator or a monarchical communicator. And then you went into this environment where you were actually rewarded for that, right? Because if you're sitting at a desk talking to a camera and you seem authoritative, everyone thinks you're brilliant, and you're surrounded by other people who we think of as being good communicators, and it turns out some of them weren't great communicators on a one-on-one level. And then did you have to unlearn that? Like, with the process of working with these experts, was it unlearning things or was it appreciating new behaviors?
Well, first of all, that was great reflection.
Thanks. it's a little obvious when we've just talked about it. It feels a little bit more clumsy.
Well, so I sometimes I'm going to answer your question in a second, but just to pick up on what you just said, I sometimes get in my head about, you know, talking to people in my world who know that I'm a proponent of reflective listening and know that I'm likely to do it. I will sometimes apologize before I do it. And people are like, don't apologize. I love this shit. You know, like, so I don't care if you're using a technique on me. It's great. Having said that, the question you asked was, did I have to unlearn behavior or learn new behaviors? And I think it was probably both, but much more the latter. It was once I learned a few skills and started practicing them enough and failing a bunch, and then eventually having a few isolated successes and practice and practice and practice and seeing how it just revolutionized the interactions I was having throughout the day, it just became a self-fulfilling, you know, cycle.
So I want to point out two important things that just happened. The first is that you shared something vulnerable about yourself, right? You told me about something you did badly, that you felt bad about. And that's not like, you know, telling me like your bank account number or like, you know, the time that you cried last. But sharing that vulnerability is really, really important because, and again, this is hardwired into our brain. I can't help but like you a little bit more, or more importantly, trust you a little bit more. And then if I share something vulnerable in response, you can't help but feel like we are connected on some level. This is actually just a pro-social instinct that's encoded into our brains. The second thing that happened is that you told me something kind of important about how you move through the world, which is that I heard you say, I often learn about myself by talking to other people, that by experimenting with these different techniques, by paying attention to how they influence other people, how these conversations go. There's some people who they have to sit down and think about something and write it out with themselves before they know how they feel about it. And then there's other people, and communicators are usually these in this group, who learn how they feel about something and learn about that thing by talking about it with other people. And you've actually said to me, I'm not only someone who's social, I'm someone who being social is very important, because it helps me understand the world and myself. And both of those things are pieces of information that help us connect. Because now I know what you want to talk about. I know that if you bring up an idea, it's maybe because you want to talk through that idea. Like, we can disagree with each other a little bit, and you'll find that interesting, as do I, because it's in the disagreement that we might see something about ourselves that we didn't know before.
That's really interesting. Let me ask you, though, about vulnerability. Vulnerability can be misused or clumsily done. And I've talked about this before with Brené Brown, who has the well-deserved title of the principal proponent of vulnerability in our culture. What say you about how and when to deploy vulnerability and when not to?
So it's a great question. And we should make clear that communication is a tool. And like any tool, it can be used for good or bad, right? An axe can chop down a tree and create firewood, or it can chop into someone's neck and kill another person. And what's really important is not the tool itself. It's the wielder of that tool. There are plenty of people who are very talented at seeming vulnerable because they want to manipulate you. What's important for us is two things. I think, first of all, to make that vulnerability authentic. If you mention that your mom has passed away, or you mention that you had a child who was seriously ill, it's not authentic for me to say like, oh, I understand what that's like because I've had an ill child, because I haven't. It's also not authentic for me to steal the spotlight from you and say like, oh, let me tell you all about my aunt and when she got sick. The vulnerability for it to work, it has to be authentic. And then it has to feel authentic too. And part of communication is this kind of meta thinking, right? Where we're having a discussion, but we're also observing the conversation a little bit. And when somebody seems vulnerable and it doesn't feel authentic to you, it's good to listen to that. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen. The number one thing, though, is to not force it, not force it from yourself, but to allow it to authentically emerge.
So maybe even to monitor yourself when you, I might feel, I've been criticized on this show for, especially early on, for making it too much about myself. So I do try to monitor, and yet I know sometimes people want to hear me talk about myself. So, but I try to be very careful about when I'm going to say something revealing and whether I'm deploying that skillfully. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So when I ask you about your background, it's very natural for you to be authentically vulnerable with me, right? I've shown you that I'm interested in it. I want to learn about it. But you're right. Probably when people were critical of it, it's because the guest said something vulnerable and then you stepped on that vulnerability by sharing something about yourself that maybe is related or maybe isn't related, or that felt like you were stealing the spotlight from them and their problem onto your own problem. And that feels inauthentic. Even if it feels genuine to you, it seems inauthentic. And so the number one thing when it comes to vulnerability is don't try and reflect the other person's circumstance. Try and reflect their feelings. So if you say, you know, I had a child and then my child was sick and we've been at the hospital, my vulnerable response is to say, oh my gosh, that sounds so hard. I'm sure I would be terrified if I was in your situation. Now, I haven't stepped on your story. I haven't tried to steal the spotlight. I haven't told you all about the sick people I know in my life. But by reflecting back your emotion, I've proven to you that I'm listening and I've exposed something about myself. That's all it takes.
Coming up, Charles Duhigg talks about other techniques in his book, including the Fast Friends procedure, how to transform shallow questions into deep ones, and how to form the habits in order to become a super communicator. Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You will always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. What I've been checking out recently is called Our Share of Night. It's technically, I guess, a horror, but it's definitely literature. I mean, it's incredibly well written, absolutely fascinating. And it really does rhyme with some of the themes that we explore on this show. I highly recommend it, although I'm only through the first 15-20% of it, but already I highly recommend it. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10% or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10% or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/10%. I love cats. I make no secret of that. We've got four cats. But here's the thing about felines. They poop a lot. You need kitty litter, and you need that kitty litter to do the job, which is why I'm proud to recommend Tidy Care Alert, which has long-lasting ammonia control so your house or your apartment or your yurt or wherever you live does not smell like you have four cats or however many cats you happen to have. No judgment here. It's low dust and lightweight, which means no lugging heavy bags of cat litter up the stairs. And it's from the brand most often recommended and personally used by veterinarians. Tidy Care Alert uses color-changing crystals to detect potential concerns and help put your mind at ease. Let Tidy Care Alert help keep an eye on your cat's health. Let me ask about a few other techniques you describe in the book. What is the fast friends procedure?
The fast friends procedure. I love this. This is an experiment that was done by these two psychology professors who are married. And their basic question was they wanted to try and figure out, how can we make strangers feel closer to each other? Like, how can we make them feel like they want to be friends? So they found dozens and dozens of people, and they would bring them into a room, just two of them, and ask them to have an hour-long conversation. And what they did is they gave them a list of questions, 36 questions. And the way it worked was that you would ask a question of the other person, they would answer it, and then they would ask that same question of you, and you'd go back and forth and do this. The big part of the experiment is that people walk out of that room after an hour, and this is pre-internet, so it's not like it's easy to like find each other online. They walk out of that room, and the experimenters say, okay, thanks, like catch you later, you know, go your separate ways. And then 7 weeks afterwards, they follow up with everyone who had been in those rooms, and they ask them one question. Did you seek out the person you were in that conversation with? Now, for most of us, if we walk into a room and we have a crazy conversation with a stranger, we're going to be like, that was a good experience, but I'm never going to see this person again. Instead, they found that 70% of the people in those rooms sought out the other person. They looked them up in the phone book. They would walk around campus looking for them. They would go out to beers together. They would see movies together. Three people ended up getting married to the person that they met in this experiment. And the reason why it worked is because the questions were deep questions. It created a sense of closeness to ask someone deep questions about their background, their values, their beliefs. When we are asked that, and then the other person responds similarly, it's impossible not to feel closer to each other. And I will say, you can look it up, like the Times did a piece, the 36 questions that lead to love. You can find them online, and they're wonderful questions. I do them in the car with my kids. They're really just fantastic questions. But the key is to go back and forth and then to reflect on what the other person has said and what it means to you. Now, in real life, the questions are things like, you know, tell me about your mother, or when's the last time you cried in front of another person, right? Or what's your biggest mistake? Let's say you're on a first date. If you lead off a first date with like, tell me about the last time you cried in front of another person, it's not going to go well, right? These questions are really useful with someone we already know or in a laboratory setting. But it turns out that these questions, the Fast Friends Protocol, there are versions of them that work in real life. And the way that they work in real life is to usually ask a simple question and then follow up by trying to make it deep, such as, you know, what do you do for a living? I'm a lawyer. Do you love practicing law? Did you always want to be a lawyer? When did you decide to go to law school? And then when they say, you know, I decided to become a lawyer because I saw my dad getting harassed by the cops and I wanted to help fight that. If I say something like, you know, it's really interesting that you mentioned that because I decided to become a journalist because I saw my dad do X and Y and Z. That's a way for us to start establishing this relationship and to feel close to each other.
You've touched on the subject of deep questions many times during the course of this interview. Can you just say a little bit more about tactically how we can learn how to transform, I guess, shallow questions into deep questions?
There's a guy named Nick Epley, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, who's spent his whole life working on deep questions. And he actually got to it because he got pulled over in high school. He got pulled over for a DUI twice. His parents would lecture him and his teachers would lecture him and the cops would lecture him. He was basically about to like destroy his life, right? And so his parents sent him to this psychologist. And the psychologist, instead of lecturing him or instead of giving him advice, she just asked him questions. And each question was a version of why. So Nick Epley has become convinced that actually, even though we think deep questions are going to be awkward, they're much easier to ask than we think they are. And he does these experiments where he'll bring a room of hedge funders together and he'll tell them, okay, what you're going to do next is you're going to ask each other the question, ask and answer the question, when's the last time you cried in front of another person? And he asked them, are you looking forward to this? Like, do you think this will be fun? And everyone's like, no, this is going to be terrible. I don't want to talk about that with like my hedge fund colleagues. And then they do it because he's told them they have to. And they love it. They won't shut up. They won't quit talking to each other. So his point is, actually, it's a lot easier to ask deep questions than we think it is. And the way you ask a deep question is just to ask something that says, why or what do you make of that? So for instance, give me what you think of as a shallow question.
Who's your favorite NFL player?
Okay. So I'll ask you, who's your favorite NFL player?
Well, because I'm loyal to my... I'm making it deep, so I'll just say Brock Purdy.
Brock Purdy, okay. So let me ask you, why Brock Purdy? Like, what is it about him that you like so much?
I don't know Brock Purdy at all. He's the quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, but my brother-in-law is a 25-year-old who just got a job as a scouting assistant for the 49ers, and it's like the best job in the world, and he's so happy there, and my 9-year-old son is obsessed with his uncle and with the 49ers and went out there and got to meet Brock Purdy, and he was really nice.
Oh my God, you just told me so much about yourself and how you see the world, right? You told me that you have this brother-in-law who you could hate, but actually you really like him, right?
Like him.
The fact that he's so excited is meaningful to you. And then you told me that family is really important to you because your 9-year-old loves his uncle and actually has a relationship with him. And then that Brock Purdy, like the thing you know about him is not like how many touchdowns he's like scored. It's that he's really nice. He's nice to kids. So now I know about your values. Like what you really appreciate is you appreciate kindness.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You asked me for a shallow question and I said, who's your favorite NFL player? And it was as simple as you saying why that turned it from shallow to deep.
Right. And the other person never will feel like you're being overly intimate, right? If you say, why did you say X or why X? They're just going to feel like you're interested in them. They're never going to be like, oh my God, that guy is really, really intrusive.
We've talked about a bunch of really winning and scientifically validated ways to become a super communicator. It strikes me that in many areas of, if not all aspects of personal development, personal growth, whatever, the biggest obstacle is just remembering to do the thing that you've told yourself you want to do. You have been on the scene for a while, but I think it's reasonably safe to say really burst into the national consciousness through a book about habits. And I'm curious what you would recommend from that perspective about how we form these habits.
You're exactly right. And thank you for asking the question that way, because the answer to how do we make this instinctual is to make it into a habit. Let me just give a little bit of perspective on how habits work. We think of a habit as one thing, but it's actually made up of three parts. There's a cue, which is a trigger for this behavior that's hopefully automatic. There's the behavior itself, the thing that we think of as the habit. And then there's a reward. Every habit in your life delivers a reward to you, whether you're aware of it or not. And so let's think a little bit about how we make these behaviors instinctual, habitual, when it comes to conversation. The first thing we have to do is we have to sort of remind ourselves and learn to look for the cues, right? So if you say something vulnerable, that should be a cue for me to be vulnerable myself or to acknowledge your vulnerability. If you show me that you're interested in a practical topic, that you just want to figure out what the plan is, that should be a cue for me that this is a practical conversation, that this is about what's this really about. So just training ourselves to look for those cues is pretty easy. Like actually, now that I've said it, most people are trained on how to do it who are listening, and you'll think about it the next time you're in a conversation. Then there's the routine, right? And we spend a bunch of time talking about the behavior that you use to draw someone out or to connect with someone. Here's the important part. You have to give yourself a reward, or you have to recognize the reward. The more we let ourselves experience the reward, the more those instincts will become habits. Secondarily, if a conversation doesn't go well, but you did all the right things. You asked the deep question. Maybe for whatever reason, you just didn't click. It's important to let yourself feel good about that as well. To say like, look, I talked to Dan today and I really wanted to talk about this like one thing in the book and we never got to it. But rather than feeling bad about that, because I think I did everything really well, I'm going to focus on the fact that like I tried. I actually was really good at asking deep questions and I've learned something. I've learned that like when talking to Dan, like ask this kind of question, not that kind of question. That's where we kind of hit some gravel, which didn't actually happen, but I'm just using it as an example. To let myself feel good about trying these things makes it into a habit. I'm giving myself a reward. And that cue routine reward, as it becomes more and more reinforced, you'll just start doing it automatically.
Yeah, I found that absolutely to be the case for me.
Can I ask you something about that?
Mm-hmm.
I imagine when someone told you, Dan, you suck at one-on-one conversations. You got to go work. I imagine that was hard to hear.
Yes.
And then I'm guessing that talking to those consultants the first couple of times, you're like, look, like this guy's full of it. What did you do to start building those habits? How did you reward yourself that made it easier to hear that criticism and to react to it?
I'm a little bit of a mutant when it comes to habit formation in that I don't actually struggle that much. The stubbornness that I referenced early on is both my superpower and my Achilles heel. So if I set my mind to something, I will do it. And I sometimes will do it even when I am in the face of good arguments that should dissuade me. I did have doubt when I was interacting at first with my communications coaches. What I did persevere though, and I did specifically with reflective listening, I just tried it a bunch. At first I couldn't remember to do it and I would beat myself up for not remembering to do it. But a couple times I remembered to do it. And one key thing that was really helpful was that Dan and Mudita would say to me, don't wait for some big moment to do it. Do it in a mundane conversations. And as soon as I just started doing the thing, I saw how positively people reacted to it. And it was off to the races because it was so clear from early on that people loved it, that I just was so powerfully incentivized to keep doing it. And one other thing I will say is that because I had these coaches, I would then go back to Dan and Mudita and tell them about it. And that was a reward too, because they were so happy that I was getting it right.
Yeah. And what I love about what you just said is it's exactly the habit loop, right? They helped you identify a new cue. Like, don't wait for some deep thing. Just look for any mundane topic that you can reflect back. And then not only did you feel a reward and you allowed yourself to recognize the reward from that behavior, but then it was reinforced by talking to your coaches.
Yes.
There's been a bunch of experiments showing that when we decide that something is a reward, it actually becomes more rewarding. So for instance, saying like, you know, it's hard to ask a reflective question, but I did it and it really worked. Simply just saying that to yourself and then having someone else say it to you or telling them about it, it actually makes that reward more rewarding.
Yeah. I think it was Dan Klerman who said to me, and I think I'm saying this accurately, and if I'm saying it accurately, I think it's true, that savoring victories, you know, in the sphere of personal development can put the learnings into your molecules in a pretty profound way. Is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And not only savoring the victories, oftentimes it's very healthy to re-remember something in the way that you wish you had done it. So I do this all the time. You know, I screw something up. I say the wrong thing in a conversation. I approach someone the wrong way. And then I'll say like, okay, so what should I have done differently? And I'll actually replay in my head the whole scene where I did exactly the right thing. And I'll do that two or three times until that memory seems as real as what actually happened. Mm. Because what I'm doing is I'm training my brain like, this is what you should do next time. We as a species are so prone to paying attention to our mistakes, right? And that's healthy because when you're in the jungle, if you make a mistake, it's going to kill you. So you want to really pay a lot of attention to your mistakes. But in contemporary society, we can make a lot more mistakes without it meaning that we're going to die. And so this capacity to pay attention to our mistakes, it sometimes reinforces the negative lesson from that mistake. And we need to take advantage of saying, okay, I know what I should have done differently. I'm going to think that through and pretend that's what I did so that next time I'm in that situation, that's the instinct that comes out.
We're bumping up against the end of our time here, but let me bring you back to the question of the stakes here. Mm-hmm. Why are these communication skills so important for us as individuals and for us as a collective, as a species?
They are vitally important. Like, I think most of us like America. Like, we think it's a good experiment. When you think about, like, what sets America apart from other places, historically, it's been that we can have conversations across divides, right? The Constitutional Convention was a bunch of people sitting down and arguing with each other and deciding together when they hated each other, deciding together what the Constitution should be. If you look at all the times that we're most proud of, not only in this country, throughout the world, it's usually because people managed to have conversations with each other and to come to a consensus, to behave and act in a way that makes the world better. But also, if you just look at the individuals, there is like literally hundreds of studies that show in order to succeed at business, having some technical skills is important at the beginning of your career. And then pretty quickly, once you become senior, it's all about communication. That's what a CEO does. A CEO spends all of their time communicating their vision over and over and over again in different ways until they've sort of aligned everyone. The best team you've ever been on is probably a team where the leader of that team was someone who was a super communicator who drew you out and made you feel like your contributions mattered. Every marriage succeeds or fails based not on whether the people like each other or they have anything in common. It's based on whether they can communicate with each other well. We are living through a period where not only have we forgotten how to communicate a little bit, and some of that is because of politics and some of that is because of the internet, but for some people, communication has become a negative thing, right? They would rather be someone who knows how to shout louder than the other side than someone who knows how to talk to the other side and understand what they're saying. And particularly as we go into this political season, we face a choice. And the choice is, are we a nation that wants to have a conversation, to learn from each other, to come together as a people? Or are we a nation and are we individuals who want not to have conversations, but just to scream at each other? Because if I can scream louder than you, then maybe I win, or if you can scream louder than me. And the truth of the matter is, if we both scream as loud as we can, nobody ends up winning. So that's why I think this is so important. That's one of the reasons I wrote this book now, is because we are a people, as a species, as a nation, as just humans. We have always succeeded by communicating. And there are times in history when we've been better at it and worse at it. Learning how to do it hopefully makes us better.
I think we're joking earlier when you talked about an inner monologue of, oh, there was one thing in the book I really wanted to talk about and I didn't get a chance. But before I let you go, was there something in the book that you really wanted to talk about that I didn't give you a chance to talk about?
No, I mean, I'll mention a couple of fun stories. So in the 1990s, NASA had to figure out how to find a different kind of astronaut. Because they were talking about building the space station. People were going to go into space for 6 months to 12 months. And up till then, most of the missions had been pretty short, like a week. And so NASA realized, like, we got to find people who are actually good at communicating with each other, who are good at connecting with each other, because they're like in a tin can for a year. They're going to make each other crazy if they're not good at this stuff. And the problem that they had is they had a psychologist who had to look at every applicant. And what he found was that he was very bad at figuring out who was genuinely good at communication. Because when you make it to the final round of an astronaut interview, you have learned how to answer questions. Like, you know how to, like, fake empathy and fake connection better than anyone else, fake emotional intelligence. And so he's working on this. He's trying to figure out, like, how do we actually tell who's good at this and who's just pretending to be good at this? And he's listening to old recordings of people, and some of whom became great astronauts and some of whom did not become great astronauts. And he notices that the great astronauts, they laugh differently than everyone else. Most importantly, they laugh the same way he laughs, with the same basic energy and the same basic intensity whenever he would laugh. So he changes how he interviews. Now when he comes into an interview, he comes in wearing this garish tie. He walks into the room. He spills his papers. And then he laughs uproariously about it. And about half the candidates would also laugh uproariously. They would match him. And about half the candidates would think it was weird that he was laughing uproariously and would sort of chuckle because we know we're supposed to respond to laughter with laughter. But they wouldn't really do it. They wouldn't match him. Then what he would do is he would, at some point during the interview, he would talk about how he felt when his sister passed away when they were younger. Now, this guy actually didn't have a sister. So this is all an act. He would frown and he would sort of let a quiver into his voice. And then he would pay attention to how the astronaut applicant reacted. Did they ask him questions? Did they talk about a loss they had experienced in their own life? Did they match him? Or did they give him his space and let him have his moment without engaging with it? That doesn't mean that they're a bad person, but it means that they don't take connection as seriously as everyone else. So they've changed a little bit because this has become public knowledge, but the way to become an astronaut is to laugh the same way someone else, the interviewer, laughs, and then to ask them questions and emote yourself when they show some emotion. I love that story because when we talk about nonverbal communication, body language, it turns out that there's a science to that as well. And the science is, when we match someone's energy and we match their intensity, what's known in psychology as valence, then that's how we show them that we want to listen. And it turns out about 80% of laughter, as I mentioned, is not in response to something funny. When we laugh to show the other person we want to connect with them. And when they laugh back, they're showing us that they want to connect with us. And you and I have laughed a lot in this conversation. Neither of us has said anything particularly funny, right? I'm laughing right now and you're laughing back. It's because I'm showing you I want to connect with you and you're accepting my invitation. You're showing me that you want to connect back. And I just love that.
And I love that there's so much science here, that this is adjudged to be a worthy field of academic endeavor, especially given that it's such an undervalued skill in the culture at large.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we're very lucky to be living during this time because our understanding is increasing so much.
Well, thank you for adding to it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And may I say, I hope this doesn't seem like a compliment just for compliment's sake. You're really good at this. One of the things I appreciate is you're really good at asking questions and kind of listening closely and showing with your questions that you're listening closely, but then also offering yourself up, not in a way that feels intrusive, but that feels genuine. I feel like this is kind of a masterclass in super being a super communicator.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you. Before I let you go, can you just please remind everybody of the name of the book and any other resources you put out into the world? Please just plug everything.
I have a copy here. It's a Super Communicators, How to Unlock the Secret Language of Connection. And if anyone wants to learn more about me or more about my books, I also wrote The Power of Habit and another one called Smarter, Faster, Better. If you just Google my name or any of the book's names, my website will come up. And I'll mention, I actually have my email address on the website and I read and respond to every single email I get from readers. Cause I sort of feel like if you spent the time to share with me, I have this obligation to kind of reciprocate. So anyone who wants to send me an email, I'm charles@charlesduhigg.com. It might take a couple of days or a week, but I promise I'll read it and write back.
Amazing. You're making me feel bad about my lack of generosity in that regard.
You shouldn't feel bad.
Well, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. It's you're doing a positive thing yet again by putting this book out into the world. So thank you.
Thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Charles Duhigg. You heard me mention some other podcast episodes during the course of this podcast episode, including my conversations with Dan Klerman and Mudita Nisker. I've put links to both of those episodes in the show notes. Before I go, I just want to thank everybody who works so hard on the show. 10% Happier is produced by Gabrielle Zuckerman, Justine Davey, Lauren Smith, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. And Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing team. And Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. And finally, Nick Thorburn of the great band Islands wrote our theme. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.